up with the guests and topics on What's the 411 with Sharon Kay. Friend us on Facebook and Twitter. Search under Sharon Kay's 411.
It's What's the 411. Here again, Sharon Kay.
All right, to Nashville. Sharon Kay is in the house. Mighty glad to be on Jazzy 88 WFSK Historic Fisk University. And I am trying to keep my viral cold thing under arrest so it will not bust out like it did last hour. And I'll tell the guest in advance if I, you know, we got a cough button and I'm going to hit it. So, and I apologize.
So if it goes quiet.
So I'm still with you. If it goes mute and you don't hear me talking, it's simply because, you know, I had to, you know. But anyway, I am doing my best to keep that at a minimum so that I'm able to conduct this first interview of 2020. Now, I'm happy to welcome to the show Jenny Eaton Dyer. And Dr. Dyer is a proud alum of Vanderbilt University. Go Doors. And well, you know, we're right down the street, so I can't help but say go Doors, you know.
I know.
And she is the founder of the 2030 Collaborative. And tell us what the 2030 Collaborative is, because I hadn't heard of it before.
Yes. Well, thank you, first of all, Sharon Kay, for having me on this show. I am so honored and privileged to be here this Sunday morning.
Now, you know, I love you already. I love you already. Because so many, so many of the, you know, I've had, I feel very fortunate to have had some of the creme de la creme of the faith-based authors on. And, you know, hearing that from you, I just feel so much better.
Oh, gosh. Well, I hope you get to feeling better because you do sound like you've got a little bit of a cold. But maybe by the end of the show, you'll be back in action. Yeah, so I'm from Nashville.
Oh.
I'm from Middle Tennessee and teach at Vanderbilt and went to Vanderbilt.
Uh-huh.
I did take a class at Fisk when I was at Vanderbilt, I would like to note, in Southern Literature. So I've been over to the campus a few times. And, you know, love Nashville. I have been working on global health out of Nashville for the last 20 years.
Mm.
So I have worked from the beginning of the Bush administration through the Obama administration and now into the Trump administration on these issues around HIV and AIDS, extreme poverty, TB and malaria, and nutrition and family planning and the list goes on, clean water for these years, really looking at how the U.S. can make a difference around the world, in the lives of people who live on less than a dollar a day, some of the most vulnerable people around the world, and how we can save lives.
Yeah.
And, the good news is, we have made incredible strides since 1990. Mm. But we have a ways to go.
Yeah.
So we still have work to do.
No question about it. Now, when you were here, who was your professor?
When I was there,
mm-hmm.
That is it. You know what? When I said that, I thought I better look up that professor. I'm going to look him up while I'm talking, and I will find it because I have forgotten. It was a cross course between – it was actually a course I think Vanderbilt might have led it, but it was half FIS students and half – Vanderbilt students, and we did half the course on Vanderbilt campus and half the course on Fisk campus, and we looked at, you know, like Nikki Giovanni and other amazing Fisk scholars and writers who'd come out of the university there, and then we looked at some writers who had come out of Vanderbilt in years past in literature, so it was really an amazing experience to just see all the incredible talent that has come out of Nashville over the last 100
definitely,
years.
Definitely. And now you said as a native up here, your let me get your perspective on this issue coming from, you know, Nashville has had its fair share of success in terms of some people making it but it's also had some down, you know, sides, because everybody here is not rolling in the dough. And there's a lot of poverty here. A lot of people who are living below the margins. So tell me what you think in your mind and growing up here prepared you for the work that you do now.
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, Nashville, like many other cities, you know, Nashville's unique in the sense that, you know, it's the Silicon Valley of healthcare. We have such a robust healthcare system and companies who have come out of Nashville, yet not everybody, to your point, has benefited from that healthcare or continues to benefit from that healthcare, either the services or the jobs themselves. So, you know, there's a lot of work to be done. I have worked with Senator Bill Frist, for the last 10 years, largely humanitarian. Most people don't realize he was responsible for signing the legislation for what is now PEPFAR, which has saved the lives of about 23 million people around the world with access to antiretroviral medication for AIDS. So he was a huge player in the field of global health. But he also has launched a nonprofit called Nashville Health and trying to pull together some folks in Nashville from HCA to, I know he works with a variety of folks from Metro, pulling together the various communities to rethink health and healthcare and access to healthcare in Nashville. Not that that is by any means necessarily a silver bullet. There are so many great groups working on healthcare in Nashville, but disparity and inequity is certainly something I'm aware of in Nashville, and of course that plays out worldwide, frankly. So it's a constant struggle for justice that we all are fighting for right here in our own backyard, and then all the way to you know, Iraq. I mean, you know, as you guys were talking about today, you know, Iraq is actually a location of famine right now. So, you know, there's places there that are about to dip into those issues around starvation. And they will, especially if they go into war. So,
Definitely.
So, yeah. So all of these experiences play into, that, and then I would like to also note, I mean, this is a show about faith. You know, my grandfather was a pastor, and I was raised in the church and I'm still a Christian. You know, my faith, our faith calls us to lift up those who are struggling. You know, Matthew 25 is pretty clear on feeding those who are hungry and clothing those who need clothes and visiting those in the prison. So, you know, there's work to do, and our faith compels us to do that, among other reasons.
Well, and, you know, as I, you know, I'm thinking about, you know, with what you said about healthcare and this is Silicon Valley of it, you know, you would think people here were the healthiest on the planet, but they're not. And then you balance that out with, there are an abundance of churches here. So it's like a balancing of sorts. How do you see those communities working together in terms of health and, you know, community of faith?
Yeah, I mean, the two ideally should go to hand to hand. And that's really been my work for the last 20 years and the work of the 2030 Collaborative is this kind of niche work where I work with faith leaders in Nashville and then across the United States on educating them on these issues around on hunger, disease, poverty, and then educate them on what they can do about these issues. So there's lots people can do, right? I mean, the churches could get involved on the ground level and, you know, there's lots of prevention work to be done around health, as you know. You know, you can, from fitness programs to nutrition programs, let's say here in Nashville even, and many churches are leading those to anti-tobacco or thinking about heart health. There's a variety of different wonderful programs going on in churches to make their, or help their, you know, assist their members to become healthier people, which leads to better health. But there's also, you know, offering help and philanthropy around access to healthcare, making sure people have the funding for healthcare, and that is a huge issue. And, you know, it's not my area of expertise, but I know there's some great work being done, like in California right now around that, relieving debt around healthcare debts. And then there's also advocacy, and that's kind of where I do most of my work, which is really getting faith leaders and key lay leaders to take a step and have these conversations with their members of Congress. And you could do this at the state level. I do it at the national level to really push them from a moral perspective. And an economic one, and a security, I mean, other kind of perspectives as well on why the U.S. or why the state of Tennessee should really get involved with uplifting the poor, why this is so important for the United States to do this, from a variety of different perspectives. But of course, from the faith perspective, the first thing is like it's not only the smart thing to do, but it is the right thing to do.
The way politically, the way things are framed in this country and even in this particular state, you know, it's like you're the blight of the country. If you need a loaf of bread, if, you know, if you're going to get like something from the SNAP program or some milk for your kids, then, you know, you're part of the problems of our country. And that, you know, has been a mindset, or at least a discussion politically, to make people feel shamed or even embarrassed to get, you know, to stand in a line and try to get something, or, you know, to get the SNAP program, because, you know, the assistance was just cut to it.
Yeah.
What impact do you think that's going to have?
You know, we are living with, frankly, administration right now that's just so difficult on these issues and has created just a real problem. And to your point, a real culture around these issues and cut funding around these issues. So, you know, we've been, you know, working on nutrition. We have been on the front lines of supporting SNAP and WIC and these other programs that are so crucial for mothers and children and people who need access to proper nutrition and good food resources. It's just unacceptable, frankly. It is absolutely unacceptable. And I think that, like, we're having to fight on many different fronts right now with this administration, that this is yet another one. I mean, in the same way that the domestic programs have been cut, this administration has recommended a cut of 33% across foreign assistance, more so even in nutrition. It was up to 75% of a cut of our nutrition budget. So we've had to go on the front lines there and go to Congress and restore those cuts and explain why we can't. We can't afford to have these cuts right now when we lead the world on giving money for these issues.
Nice.
So it's a constant fight right now with who we have in the administration. I will say for Congress, having worked with Congress over the last, you know, two administrations and now this third, Congress has held the line for foreign assistance funding for global health and global development. That is, like, you know, they always enjoy a bipartisan agreement on these issues, and they have overridden the president's and this administration's recommendations for these draconian cuts. So we weren't expecting this to happen, but there has been a bit of a silver lining over the last 3 years. We have seen them hold the line to the Obama levels of funding, which is positive for nutrition and AIDS and these other issues. But it's still a fight, right? It's just every day.
When it was announced that 700,000 people were going to get hit by this, I mean, when this president throws out these boomerangs, well, I won't even call them boomerang because they don't ever come back to him. When he throws out these grenades on people, I'm wondering, does he ever think about impact? Because to me, the first thing right away I thought of was the other organizations and nonprofits in the community that stand in the gap, you know, and try to help the families that are having the food insecurities and things of that nature, and the impact it's going to have on them. And, you know, all the things that folks are dealing with, and groceries are high as the blue blazes, honey. And I have a job and groceries are high. So, you know, I don't even know if he spent a second thinking about the impact of 700,000 people. What do you think?
I think that he probably doesn't think about these things, is what I think. And I think that he's surrounded himself with people who also are not questioning these things, you know, it is our responsibility, and it's to take a stand and to really bring these questions to the fore and demand attention for these as people of faith. But to your point, it's going to fall on the church's back. It's going to fall on the nonprofit's back.
Yes.
It's going to fall on the poor themselves. And I don't think that he's thought through these consequences.
No. And the nonprofits, you know, they're fundraising like 24/7 because we're nonprofit and I get it. And, you know, you can't shake the tree but so many times before people say, don't ask me for another dime. And I mean, you know, because everybody's in the struggle. They're in a struggle that they may or may not want to admit to. If there are an estimated 36 million Americans on food stamps, that's a lot of folk in this country that, you know, are dependent on that program.
Yes.
And to kick the legs out from underneath it and tell them Happy New Year, you know, is just really kind of cold. And knowing that that's the case, then the nonprofits, as they head to this through this 2020, they got a lot to, you know, to including the faith base. They got a lot to deal with in the coming year to feed the masses for sure. Anyway, Dr. Eaton Dyer, let's take a time out because this is a subject that really bothers me because, you know, you look at people are just hungry. When you're hungry, you do stuff. Okay.
Yes.
Okay. So I want to talk about some of the consequences. Hungry people, you know, hurt others, and hungry people commit crimes, and hungry people do a lot of things. So I want to talk about hunger and knocking down some of it, what it could and how it can impact communities. Anyway, let's take a quick time out and we'll be right back.
You're listening to What's the 411 with Sharon Kay.
What's the 411 with Sharon Kay is brought to you by Terry W. Jones, independent agent, State Farm Insurance. Life insurance is one of those subjects that makes people want to change the subject rather than admit they probably don't have enough. That's why State Farm agent Terry W. Jones focuses on how the benefits of life insurance actually live on by asking people to think in terms of life without having to sell the house, insurance, or life without having to give up college, insurance. Find out how the benefits of life insurance can live on for your family. Call State Farm agent Terry W. Jones in Nashville at 615-256-6066 or online at terrywjones.net and put the life back in life insurance.
Every year, saxophonist Joe Lovano comes home to Cleveland to play a birthday show.
There were five generations of musicians in my life from Cleveland that I presented. For me, that's always been what's inspired me to want to play.
I'm Christian McBride, and we're going down memory lane with Joe Lovano. That's next time on Jazz Night in America. Catch Jazz Night in America every Sunday from 2 to 3 p.m. and Wednesdays from 6 to 7 p.m. here at listener-supported Jazzy 88.
Support for WFSK comes from Nashville Public Library. Get help with your New Year's resolutions at Nashville Public Library. They have everything from Zumba and yoga to cooking classes and smoking support groups. You can connect to the best health websites for information you can trust, and it's all free. Learn more at library.nashville.org/bewell@npl. That's library.nashville.org/bewell@npl.
Keep up with the guests and topics on What's the 411 with Sharon Kay. Friend us on Facebook and Twitter. Search under Sharon Kay's 411.
It's What's the 411. Here again, Sharon Kay.
Alrighty, Nashville, Sharon Kay is in the house. Mighty glad to be on Jazzy 88 WFSK Historic Fisk University. And What's the 411 with Sharon Kay is brought to you by Terry W. Jones, Independent Agent, State Farm Insurance. We thank you so very much for supporting What's the 411. This morning, our book is entitled The End of Hunger, Renewed Hope for Feeding the World. And the author, Dr. Jenny Eaton Dyer, is with me this morning from her home in Franklin. She's the founder of the 2030 Collaborative, and she has also written widely on the intersection of religion and global health, and is a native of Nashville, correct?
Yes, ma'am, I am.
Where'd you go to school at, high school and stuff?
Well, I grew up in Murfreesboro, so I went to half of my high school was at Oakland High School, and half of my high school was at Brentwood Academy.
Okay.
And then I went to college at a little school in Birmingham called Samford University. And then I did my graduate work back in Nashville at Vanderbilt University.
Okay. And you also are a professor there, right?
Yes, yes, I am.
Oh, so you straight up Commodores all the way.
I am. I've been a Commodore for a while now.
No, nobody better not question that, you know.
That's right. It's been 20 years.
Oh, wow.
20 years.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Have you, you know, since you're from here and all that, and you are alum and teach, are you into your second or third generation of people that, you know, say, oh, my God, you're a professor, you know?
Yeah, I mean, yeah. So I've been teaching for a little over 10 years now at Vanderbilt, and they have moved on. I mostly teach graduate students, mm-hmm. Although I have taught undergraduate, and I've taught at the Divinity School, but mostly I've taught at the Med School in health policy. And yes, they have all moved on to health policy careers now. So it's been. Yeah. It's been fun to watch them, and their careers grow.
Definitely, definitely. And the facts that you had a hand in on training another, you know, generation of advocates.
Right, which is so important, right?
Definitely. Now, before the break, I had mentioned, you know, I know being hungry, you know, anybody who's ever gone without or hungry, you know, it can do stuff to you. And people know when you get hungry, you know, you know, some of y'all will hurt somebody if you don't get something to eat. And that's real. It also has, you know, brought about changes in people's, you know, behavior and action, et cetera. Can you discuss on a global perspective what you know, starvation and going hungry actually does to your spirit and to your mind?
Oh, gosh. Yeah, I mean, I'm not a, you know, medical doctor, so I'm not an expert on this, but the good news about this book is that we did rely on so many different experts for the book. You know, it's a collection of essays from political folks to doctors to just people, activists who are passionate about these issues. And we open the book with kind of this question by a scientist, Mike McCark, who addresses what hunger does to your brain, when you experience acute and chronic hunger. And I mean, you know, I have been fortunate enough not to experience hunger and malnutrition in that way. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I can only empathize. But it depletes the stores and the glycogen in your brain, mm-hmm. and you really aren't able to think clearly. So, you know, whether you're in Nashville or if you're in Yemen, mm-hmm. Your body starts to break down, mm-hmm. you know, and your organs begin to shut down, and you are truly in a desperate state. So you're, to your point, people in desperate states make desperate mm-hmm. decisions to have access to nutrition to survive. Mm-hmm. And, you know, nutrition, we believe, is a right. I mean, everyone has the right to good nutrition. Mm-hmm. They should have access to good nutrition. This is just a fundamental building block of survival, to have access to clean water and good nutrition, again, here and around the world. So it does something to the individual. Of course, it does something to the community. Mm-hmm. And it means a world of difference if you can reverse that course, right? Right. And the individual, particularly mothers, pregnant mothers, mm-hmm. And they have access to nutrition, and communities have access to nutrition, and where you can prevent what's called stunting. Mm. And I don't know if your listeners know much about stunting. You know, we don't see it much in the United States, mm-hmm. in spite of our poverty, mostly because, you know, while there are pockets of the United States who experience things like the developing world, and there is stunting that exists, it's not nearly to the degree of, say, Guatemala or some other nations, where actually a quarter of all children around the world experience stunting. Mm, mm. It's a huge issue. And that means cognitively and that means physically. Mm. The stature of the child will never be of average height, and their brain mm-hmm. literally never completely develops. So it's a chronic and irreversible course that happens in the first 3 years of life. So I just say all this to say that nutrition is so important for everyone, but it's particularly important if you want to change a generation mm-hmm. and stop this act of stunting, because it can change the tide and change the cycle of poverty in a family, in a community, mm-hmm. and in fact, in a nation, mm-hmm. if you can address nutrition properly, which gets to your point of not only the individual, but just security issues. Mm-hmm. You know, if you can change these behaviors, and if nutrition is the linchpin, you can really change the world mm-hmm. To make it a better place. So you can't overstate enough that it's such a critical building block for everyone.
Now, how does this, when you're working globally like that and you have different religious beliefs and etc., how does that work when you're coming in there as a Christian talking about the Bible and God, thus said the Lord, and all, and those people don't even know what you're talking about? How does all that work, you know, towards the goal? And do you address that in your new book?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. So it's a little more complicated in the work that we do. So mm-hmm. we're really advocating that the U.S., and I don't know if you know this, but over half the Americans, when polled, when asked how much does the U.S. give to foreign assistance, they think it's 25%. But the reality is it's less than 1%. So less than 1% of our U.S. budget actually goes to all of these programs that I've been talking about, from HIV/AIDS to nutrition. Mm. So we're talking about a fraction of the budget, mm-hmm. And we lead the world in terms of the quantity mm-hmm. of funding for this. So, you know, part of that 1% funding does go to faith-based organizations who mm-hmm. implement this funding, churches or nonprofits, and they are promoting and proselytizing and sharing the gospel mm-hmm. with folks, not with U.S. funding, because they can't do that per se, but alongside, right? Yeah. Because they are a faith-based entity. World Vision or World Relief do these kinds of things. Samaritan's Purse, other groups, many other groups. So they're coming hand in hand with this. But the kind of funding that we're talking about is also going through the World Food Program and numerous other food programs, even through USAID, Food for Peace. There's a host of other programs. The Global Food Security Act goes through the through USAID and the State Department. And all of these implementers are really giving food first. So it's a mixed. The money is given to a variety of groups, some with faith-based intentions and faith-based efforts, and some that are not. But overall, the funding we're talking about is about providing access to nutrition first and foremost.
So when it comes to, like, locally, how do you get, you know, I know your messaging, after doing this for all these years, is pretty succinct, but how do you get people to understand, you know, at the granular level, it's important for you to care about somebody's nutrition someplace else, and you might not have a full refrigerator yourself.
Right. That is, you know, that is a very difficult question, and it's very complicated, right? So, I mean, many of those folks may need to be fighting for access to nutrition themselves here, right? And others need to be fighting for them to have access to good nutrition and others around the world. There, you know, like I said, you know, the United States, there are pockets that certainly experience hunger like some developing nations, but by and large, the extreme poverty that you might see in Haiti or even some countries in Africa is a different kind of poverty than we typically see in the United States. And it's hard to fathom that, A, if you're struggling with hunger yourself, or if you've never actually seen it, but to live on less than a dollar a day and have to choose which child gets fed that day and rotate that, to want to give away your children because you cannot take care of them. You know, you're talking about horrible decisions around trafficking and the like, without access to any health care, perhaps without access to any clean water. It is difficult to imagine, but it exists in almost about a billion people around the world live like that. And the numbers have been decreasing. So, I want to remain somewhat optimistic because we do know how to cut back extreme poverty and those living with extreme poverty and to help lift them up. We know how to cut, hunger. We know how to treat hunger. We know how to treat, a variety of different diseases. Yeah. And we've been doing that. We've cut those numbers in half over the last 25 years. It's just we still have halfway to go. So that's extreme poverty. That's not poverty, which is different. But there is hope, and there is a will to move forward.
In part one, and I will. This is a section that is from Ron Sider, The Bible, Poverty, Justice, and Christian Obedience. What does he contribute to your book?
You know, Ron has worked in the issues around faith and justice, social justice, for years and years. He works up with Tony Campolo in Pennsylvania at Eastern University. You know, I haven't read Ron's piece in quite some time, but he really does look into God's special concern for the poor. he looks at the construction of sin as more of a social construction, not individual. And he looks at economic justice issues. So he's looking, he's going to take a look, a more structural look at hunger and justice and what society and, you know, what we're called to do as a society and thinking about these issues as, you know, as sin and how we can be a part of the answer instead of part of the problem. So it's actually a great contribution to the book, and looking at how our role as Christians is beyond merely donating to your nonprofit, but how you can get involved with systemic changes for these issues, which is really, really the thrust of the message of the entire book.
Well, you know, I don't know how often. And next I'll ask you this, because I know you go to your church all the time and stuff. Does your pastor engage in discussions about hunger?
Yes.
Locally and globally, or just locally?
Both.
Okay.
You know, I've been in many churches over the city for many years, and I find that most pastors tend to talk about hunger locally and globally, but very from a more simplistic perspective, where you simply just are to donate money to, you know, Second Harvest, or, you know, bring in your cans of food, or, you know, these kinds of issues, these kinds of kind of one-to-one taking action, which is important in every community. But it, I do find that most pastors don't talk about what Ron Sider's getting at, which is getting at these structural issues and how the church can be involved in changing legislation, which is getting back to our original discussions around SNAP and WIC and global nutrition funding to make sure that there are proper laws in place and funding in place for vulnerable individuals and communities to have access to nutrition as a right.
How deep does he go? That's true. It's like depends, a surface thing here.
It depends on the type of ministry. If you have a ministry that is more of a social justice type ministry that deals with these issues on a regular, that addresses these issues just as she's saying, in terms of advocating for legislation, things of that nature, as well as involved in missionary trips to some of these countries, helping to personally send people there to see what's going on, establish relationships. It's hard because that in itself takes funding. So it's sort of touch and go, you know, depending on where you are.
Well, I guess it, if you're a missionary Baptist, you're on a mission.
Well, something like that. That's probably more local, but you know, you do have people who go and put boots on the ground and say, okay, let's go out here and see, you know. And, because I went to Catholic school from second grade to ninth grade, so I'm very familiar with the nuns who would go over, who would establish themselves in some of these. That's why I came to know who Mother Teresa was. You know, things, you know, just. It's mission. It's hard
but
work.
You're
it's
not
hard
Catholic
work.
Now, though.
No,
I was partially raised because I don't. You know, sometimes. You know, different. When you grow older, different issues.
But she's hitting the nail right on the head. It takes. You have to get out there and advocate for it. You really have to do. You have to.
Because I believe that a lot of them, you know, talk about giving. They have the box, and you know, you bring food and put it in the thing. But
and it can't be. And I don't mean any harm, but if it's depending on the race of your church makeup, then it can't be we're going to go feed the starving kids in Africa. It has to be a holistic understanding, teaching of why this is biblical in itself.
Well, that's part of what my question entails is it being used as part of, you know, the sermon or the teachings of the particular ministry? Because some, you know, have to...
Depends on the pastor.
Well, in some churches, they don't want to hear that stuff. Mm-mm. They just want to hear that I'm going to have these things and this stuff, and God going to send me a man, and, you know, God going to send me this and God going to send me that and the pie and the pie and the pie in the sky. They're not interested in that other stuff. I mean, because some people go to church for different reasons.
That's how they were taught.
Yeah.
It all starts at the top.
You know, anyway, when we come back, Doctor.
But then you bring our guest in and allow her to give a lecture or teach a class to help educate the body of Christ.
Well, Franklin, Tennessee. Anyway, Dr. Dyer, we're going to, let's say I got started now. Let's see, X is just conjuring. I know how he does. You know, he's good at conjuring up stuff on the show for sure.
No, thank you for that. Thank you for that contribution.
Anyway, let's take a time out and we'll be right back.
You're listening to What's the 411 with Sharon Kay.
What's the 411 with Sharon Kay is brought to you by Terry W. Jones, independent agent, State Farm Insurance. Life insurance is one of those subjects that makes people want to change the subject rather than admit they probably don't have enough. That's why State Farm agent Terry W. Jones focuses on how the benefits of life insurance actually live on by asking people to think in terms of life without having to sell the house, insurance, or life without having to give up college, insurance. Find out how the benefits of life insurance can live on for your family. Call State Farm agent Terry W. Jones in Nashville at 615-256-6066 or online at terrywjones.net and put the life back in life insurance.
It's What's the 411 with Sharon Kay.
Hello, Nashville. Coming up Wednesday afternoon at 4, community news and the traffic. Then women's success coach and author Bonnie Marcus helps us navigate the politics of promotion. And at 5 o'clock, getting your new year off to a fresh start with motivational speaker and author Adonis Lindsay. Your questions and comments are always welcome.
That's What's the 411 with Sharon Kay, twice a week, every Wednesday afternoon from 4 to 6 p.m. and every Sunday morning from 7 a.m. to 9 a.m. right here on Jazzy 88 WFSK.
Keep up with the guests and topics on What's the 411 with Sharon Kay. Friend us on Facebook and Twitter. Search under Sharon Kay's 411.
It's What's the 411. Here again, Sharon Kay.
All righty, Nashville. Sharon Kay is square up in the middle of the house, you know me. I'm in there. And we're mighty glad to be on Jazzy 88 WFSK. First Sunday in 2020. I can see clearly now. Can you see clearly? Hopefully you can. And using those eyes to see how good God has been to all of us. Today's book discusses the gospel work of eradicating global nutrition, malnutrition rather, and feeding the hungry, the end of hunger, renewed hope for feeding the world is today's book. And we've been having a conversation this morning with native Middle Tennessean, Dr. Jenny Eaton Dyer. And she is founder of the 2020 Collaborative as well as a professor at Vanderbilt University. Now, Dr. Jenny, let me go part two, part three, because in the book, because that's kind of the area that we are hovering in now and the subject discussion that we had prior to the break. And this is kind of the people that I see that you have covered. Have discussed this issue with are kind of hitting it from that perspective and what the church collective can do. And as you have gone around the region, this region and also globally, do you think that the church is addressing this because of poverty and food insecurities and issues of that nature that we're dealing with in this country? Do you think the church has been addressing this as it should, or are they just doing surface?
You know, I think some churches are doing an incredible job addressing this. And then I think some churches, there's some work to be done. So I do think it's, you know, there's not a good one answer for this. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a variety, there's lots of different churches and denominations out there, and
sure.
Some local churches are doing incredible jobs, and some denominations are doing good jobs, and some could stand to learn a little bit more about what more they could do to change issues around malnutrition at home and abroad. There's work to be done.
Yeah.
But this is my experience. My experience in working with faith leaders is that usually when you sit down with them one-on-one in their office or over lunch, or you sit down in a small group setting, mm-hmm. and you take the time to have these kinds of conversations like you and I are having right now,
mm-hmm.
they get it by and large, like a really, like 95%,
mm-hmm.
and they are supportive no matter their political stripe or mm-hmm. religious stripe or racial stripe or whatever stripe. They get it. They know it. It is the fundamental teaching of the gospel, of the red letters of Jesus, and they are asking what more they can do.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really, I think, incumbent upon those of us who are working in these issues, these more structural issues, and taking that more that perspective, mm-hmm. to spend the time and educate and promote awareness for these opportunities for advocacy around nutrition locally and globally.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's the critical piece of activating those churches that may not be participating in mm-hmm. advocacy right now.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, not so long ago, I don't recall people really talking about it as much as they do now, and that is food insecurity. Do you address that, or is it discussed at all in your book?
Yes, we do address food insecurity in the book, mm-hmm. Because it's a major issue here and around the world.
Mm-hmm.
You know, kind of circling back to your discussion in the last hour, conflict nations create the most gap for food insecurity.
Mm-hmm.
So that is famine. You know, famines are not God made. They are man-made.
Mm-hmm.
They are driven by conflict, frankly.
Mm-hmm.
So it's important, you know, at the roots of nutrition and in fighting malnutrition, to have stability to combat food insecurity.
Mm-hmm.
So that folks can have, you know, good access to the distribution mm-hmm. of food resources. Otherwise, you know, in Yemen, we're seeing some 20 million folks living on the brink of starvation mm-hmm. or in starvation because of the conflict going on, and they can't get access mm-hmm. to proper food
mm-hmm.
in the channels. So food insecurity here and around the world is of top concern, even if it, as it deals with the foreign policy issues we're talking about this weekend.
Yeah. Well, and what impact do you think that, you know, the wars, the constant wars in the Middle East and, you know, et cetera, are going to have on, you know, the global hunger problem?
Well, absolutely. The wars in Syria mm-hmm. and wars around in the Middle East,
mm-hmm.
And even northern Africa, Libya, Sudan, in these areas of conflict states, mm-hmm. you see famine, people living on the brink of famine. These are the highest levels mm-hmm. of malnutrition. So, again, stability and fighting insecurity is just foremost. Mm-hmm. And if we want to truly tackle nutrition, and if we have been able to cut those living in hunger in half over the last mm-hmm. 25 years, we're going to tackle that last 800 million people who are living with hunger still.
Mm.
Stability is going to be a big part of it,
mm-hmm.
Of ensuring good diplomacy across nations and being helpful there.
Is the way neighborhoods are planned, is that, you know, from attending grassroots things over the years, you know, neighborhoods have said, particularly black neighborhoods, There's no fresh groceries, no, you know, vegetables and things of that nature in, you know, certain neighborhoods, you know, particularly black inner city or black neighborhoods, et cetera. Is that part of the insecurity?
Absolutely. Yeah, food deserts, as, you know, I'm sure you're aware of, Ben. One of the major issues that many organizations across the U.S. are addressing right now, even in Nashville, you know, making sure that there are access to grocery stores that are providing fresh fruits and vegetables at a good price across Nashville and then across the nation. So, yeah, I mean, absolutely. These, you know, different neighborhoods, different zonings, different these issues around access to nutrition and the transportation to get the nutrition is certainly one key problem that we're going to have to address in the coming years.
Now, I've heard people say some of the things that they've gotten from some of the banks, the food banks and different places, has not really been that fresh. Is that, what kind of issue is that for, you know, the people that are trying to, just because you're hungry doesn't mean you have to just take stuff.
Right.
You know, I mean, so what can you talk about that, please?
You know, I'm going to be honest. I'm not an expert on that, on local distribution of foods. So I can't speak as an expert to that, but absolutely everyone should have the right to access to fresh fruits and vegetables, to get the proper nutrients and micronutrients and iron and folate and protein that they need to combat malnutrition. So, yeah, I mean, that should be the mission. I don't know how it's being carried out successfully or unsuccessfully. In what groups here in town, but certainly that should be the goal.
Now, they, you know, they used to have like soup kitchens and all that in the churches and lunches and stuff like that. That's a, that's a good local boots on the ground thing. What else can a church do? You know, you mentioned, I think actually you might say the collection of the cans and all that. What else proactively? And do you address being proactive for the community of faith in the book?
You know, not as much as probably we should in the book, because it's a little more geared to towards thinking of people outside of the U.S. than in the U.S., though some of it is definitely domestic. But, you know, as we were kind of talking earlier, prevention for health is so key. So making sure, you know, people can have... people can give, and they can give their time, they can volunteer, they can give funding, they can donate food, they can, all these kinds of things. But they can also, you know, help start communities of health by, you know, doing fitness clubs and running clubs or walking clubs or these other kinds of exercise that play into, you know, better health. Going back to like the larger issue of health in the U.S. and in Nashville. So there's so many different ways that the church could support and does support nutrition with good education and good awareness about food and exercise and ways folks can stay healthy.
Now, I find it interesting in part 3, number 28, you have a section in here by Bob Corker. I never really thought of him as being real faith-based type guy. I guess he could have been, you know, former Senator Corker. At least he let me interview him versus the other Republicans that won't return our calls. It says, ending hunger starts with modernizing how we deliver food aid. What did he contribute?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, Bob's stepped down from his role in Congress, and you know, he's in Chattanooga. So he played a big role in thinking about nutrition and actually the delivery system of how we provide food. So So inevitably in any system there is, some inefficient means mm-hmm. by which they're using funding.
Yeah.
So he was concerned with that and was able to kind of clean up the distribution system or create some legislation around it to mm-hmm. save funding, which that funding actually went back in turn for more food.
Okay.
So there was a betterment of like 20-30% of more efficient and effective food being delivered mm-hmm. Because of this modernizing Food Aid Act that he did last year.
Okay.
He right before he left, he was able to contribute some expertise to the process.
Well,
I would
amen.
Say.
Bless Jesus. Well, hopefully he's working it out in Chattanooga.
Hopefully.
Have you been in touch with any of these people that have contributed to your book since you released it?
Yes, I have. In fact, we did a event at Parnassus mm-hmm. One day with some of these. Some folks are from Nashville. Yeah, I don't know if you noticed. Amy Grant is from Nashville. She's a Christian music artist.
Yeah, I recognize the country people on here.
Yes. Yeah. And Steve Taylor is a Christian artist here in Nashville, and the Taylor family contributed a piece.
Mm-hmm.
So there's some folks from Nashville. Senator Frist contributed a piece.
Now you know I'm black. I'm black, so I'm asking any black preachers on here.
I have some African American women who are on here who have contributed, but I do not have a male black preacher.
What?
But I have some expert African American women, and African women, who have contributed as well.
Some of these pastors step up, do some. Yeah, that'd be good because they, that's what they're supposed to do. They got so much to do, but I'm just saying. Anyway, I'm always giving people work to do, just like they always give me stuff to do. Anyway, Dr. Dyer, now next time you got to come over here and see me, okay?
I know. I need to do that, definitely.
I know.
Definitely.
It was early when I asked you, to be here and all that, but, I'm worth it.
I'm a bit of a drive away on the weekend, but I would love to meet you,
definitely. Well, if you're over this way, please do stop by and see us, okay?
I will.
Now,
I will.
Tell the audience how to find out your book and more of your work, please.
I will. So you can go to 2032030collaborative.com and learn about how you can advocate for global health and global development issues, and be a part of our faith-based coalition for global nutrition at that website.
Amen. And Dr. Dyer, thank you so much for being with us here in 2020. And this interview will rest on the Sharon Kay's 411 podcast. Please do check it out, and you'll be able to hear this one as well as the rest of them. And thank you so much, and we look forward to continued contact with you, okay?
Wonderful. Thank you so much for this opportunity.
You're
I really
welcome.
Appreciate it.
Okay. Bye-bye. All
Bye.
Right. That was Dr. Jenny Eaton Dyer, and be sure to check out her new book, and we'll be keeping up with The End of Hunger. We'll be keeping up with her. And let me leave you with 1 Corinthians 10:31. Whether therefore you eat, drink, or whatever you do, do all to the glory of God. Now, do it all to God's glory. And we thank you, Nashville. You all have the very best of the best. And please don't you forget who loves you.
You've been listening to What's the 411 with Sharon Kay. The views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of this station and its management.
Listening to What's the 411 with Sharon Kay.